From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The new state legislative session is underway. Democrats enjoy historic domination of Sacramento. Incoming Governor Gavin Newsom also expected to be more sympathetic to highly progressive bills than his predecessor. What does that mean for state spending on housing, Medi-Cal, and preschool? We'll find out right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific start to your day. Coming up, UC Berkeley and conservative groups have settled a lawsuit arising from speakers invited to campus. The conservative groups have claimed their speakers were subjected to different criteria than those invited by progressive groups. Where does the settlement leave the issue? We'll find out later this hour. But first, the new state legislative session is underway in Sacramento. Democrats hold overwhelming majorities in both the Senate and Assembly. Incoming Governor Gavin Newsom's also considered more likely to sign highly progressive bills than his predecessor, the current Governor Brown. Let's look at several of the reintroduced bills and some of the new ones with the potential for big changes in Sacramento. Joining us, Los Angeles Times Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers and CalMatters nonprofit news organization political reporter Laurel Rosenhall. Laurel and John, good to have you both with us today. Let's start just first of all with what the mood is like in Sacramento. Laurel, just give us kind of the feeling yesterday as the session got underway with, 75% Democrats in both houses.
Yeah, I mean, it's an exciting kind of a little bit like a first day of school. You know, everyone's dressed up and bringing their families. But I would say that the political mood is just overwhelmingly Democratic. And it's been many decades since there's been this many Democrats in the legislature. Anthony Rendon, the Speaker of the Assembly, even jokingly called it a giga majority because it's so much bigger than the normal supermajority, which is two-thirds of the members being Democrats. So there's a lot of, you know, hope and aspirations among those Democratic legislators that they can really get a lot done, that they can go further than they could have under Governor Jerry Brown. So there's a lot of optimism that with a new Democratic governor who is more one of their peers in terms of his years of experience and perhaps also in his interest in kind of a liberal agenda, there's a lot of optimism about what they can get done in the coming year.
John Myers, have you heard any conversations among Democrats at all, concerns about overreach or overspending? California typically is boom and bust when it comes to tax revenues. Are any Democrats expressing any concern over overreaching and putting the state into a precarious financial position several years down the road?
People talk about it right now, but I know there are Democrats who feel that. I mean, I think it's important to state that even though there are more Democrats than have been up here in modern times in Sacramento, the Democratic Party is not monolithic in the legislature. There are a fair number of business-aligned, more fiscally moderate Democrats that have pushed back on some things. I think the real question is whether there are enough of those Democrats at this point, given the large majorities that the party holds. I mean, and I think the flip side of what you were talking about at the beginning of the mood here is for Republicans. I mean, you have so few Republicans in the legislature, you could fit them in a couple of passenger vans at this point. I mean, you've got 11 in the state Senate and 20 in the state assembly. And so the Democratic dominance and what Democratic platform emerges, I think, is going to be really the story of 2019. How liberal is this Democratic legislature? How pragmatic? And then how do they get along with the new governor? And what does he see his mission to be? I think that's really the key for the next several months.
And with term limits, I guess, for the legislators, they're not going to have to worry so much about how to pay for this down the road. I mean, right now, tax revenues are going great. The California economy is humming along. So you know, maybe for Democrats at this point, this just really isn't a concern. Down the road, their successors will be the ones to have to deal with it when the economy contracts in the state. So as a practical matter, maybe it isn't an issue for them, John.
I might flip that just a little, though, Larry. I mean, because that's the other story that I think is really important for people to know out of Sacramento. This is a very experienced legislature. This was the smallest number of new members, freshman members, since any election since 1988. And the term limits did change a few years ago, where you have more time in office. So this is an experienced legislature. And I think the question is are they looking at those long-term cost pressures? Are they looking around the corner to the next recession, which is inevitable at some point in the state in California? You know, I will tell you that multiple members of the legislature have chafed at this notion that Jerry Brown was the guy that kept them in check, that they, too, know what to do when it comes to be fiscally responsible. And I think this is their chance to do that with a new governor and also with the fact that they've been around longer than the legislators did in the old term limit system, which gave them smaller times in office.
Let's talk about one of the big spending bills that's expected to get a very warm reception from the incoming governor. That's preschool expansion. Laurel, share with us what is proposed in legislation for a preschool expansion.
Yeah, yesterday an assemblyman who represents Sacramento named Kevin McCarty introduced a package of bills worth about $2 billion that would expand preschool, publicly funded preschool for 3 and 4 year olds. It is largely targeted at children who are in low-income families. So it would basically cover children who live in areas where at least 70% of children qualify for free or reduced lunch. So in terms of public school students in those neighborhoods, that's a strong indication of poverty. So, and then he also has a bill that would has to do with learning standards, educational standards in preschool, so that it would kind of align better with K-12. And this is obviously an issue that Gavin Newsom talked about a lot on the campaign trail, particularly toward the end of the campaign season. He really was talking a lot about early education. And I think the thing to look for here is how much this kind of particular proposal from this assemblyman lines up with, you know, Newsom's vision for where this policy should go.
John, let's talk about Medi-Cal expansion. It's proposed that Californians who are in the U.S. illegally would be Medi-Cal eligible over the age of 18 under one of the bills. Is there a price tag that is associated with that legislation?
Well, there have been price tags floated several times because this is not a new idea in Sacramento. I mean, this was floated during earlier this year's budget negotiations and through Democrats before that. Price tag, depending on how you score it, what the cost is somewhere about $1 billion. That's not small money, even in a state with a close to a $200 billion state budget. We cover healthcare services for the youngest folks in particular already who are here without legal status. As you said, this would expand that. This has been a priority for Democrats for a while. I don't think this is the only healthcare discussion coming. I think we're going to have a much broader discussion, certainly about things that get into the single payer universe and things like that. But this is one that, again, back to that idea of which Democrats are in control and what did they choose to focus on. There's a big price tag on this. There's a big price tag on child poverty ideas that have been floated in the last several weeks. It's going to be interesting to see this as to how much money we have and where they're going to spend it.
Well, and also in the past, if I recall, John, the Medi-Cal expansion to undocumented residents has been pitched as being, you know, essentially cost neutral, that people are being treated in emergency rooms and that this would actually, you know, it would be beneficial fiscally as well to have people have access to health care regardless of legal status. But since that time, we've had a study with the ACA implemented that shows even with more people insured, that has not reduced emergency room visits. And in fact, many people who previously weren't insured still go to the emergency room for the kind of treatment that could be handled going to see a primary care doc. So I just wonder if that research has had any sort of a chilling effect on those who support this idea.
I don't think it has so far, because I think this is a the Democrats who are pushing this have a principled stand that they think about taking care of those who don't have other affordable ways to do it. There are people who don't go through the healthcare system because of fear of immigration status and that someone will ask them questions. You know, and in terms of the cost, that is a great challenge in governing, is how you calculate the cost, what's the economic impact, what's the state budget impact. And I really think we would be remiss, Larry, if we didn't point out the fact that when you talk about Medi-Cal and you talk about it, it is a federal state program. There are dollars there and there are rules that apply to the federal government. There is a federal Trump administration component when we talk about health care for those in the country illegally. So it's a complicated topic, but it's a passionate topic. I think we're going to hear a lot more about it in the year to come.
John Myers, LA Times Sacramento Bureau Chief with us. Laurel Rosenhall, reporter for Cal Matters, the nonprofit journalism organization based in Sacramento. Laurel, let's talk about the wildfire bills. Here, Chris Holden from the Sacramento area had a bill that he was going to be introducing, which would have allowed a pass through some of the costs of liability for utility companies to ratepayers for last or this current year's fires. What's the status of that and any other bills related to this?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously wildfire legislation was a huge issue in this year's session that's already ended because of the horrible fires in the wine country area around Napa County in 2017. And the big bill that they agreed upon at the end of the summer and that was signed into law did a number of things that, you know, provided money for thinning the forests. And there were other bills on that dealt with insurance and emergency response systems and whatnot. But the really controversial piece of this has to do with the liability that the utilities bear if their power lines are involved in sparking a fire. And the bill that the governor signed into law this fall creates one plan for passing the costs onto customers for the 2017 fires and a different plan for passing a cost on for any fires that might happen in 2019 or beyond. But they didn't make any new policy on anything that might happen in 2018. And of course, all of that legislation happened before the horrific fires that we've seen in the last month, both in Butte County in Northern California and in Paradise, as well as down in your area with the Woolsey fire. So there is an assemblyman from Pasadena, Chris Holden, who proposed legislation. He sort of verbally said he wanted to create a bill that would allow that kind of passing on of costs. And I should back up by saying all of that is with the intention of avoiding bankruptcy for the big utilities, with the idea that it's kind of worse for customers if the utilities go bankrupt than if they see their bills go up by a smaller amount in order to pay off the liability. So anyway, he said he wanted to introduce a bill that would cover that gap for 2018 that has to do with the liability. And then he kind of backed away from it. And it's a very controversial thing. PG&E, which is the utility up here in Northern California, is widely despised by its customer base. And there was a lot of blowback to his proposal. So he's kind of put that one on hold. I do anticipate that he'll probably do something in the new year, but he hasn't actually introduced it yet.
All right, Laurel Rosenhall of Cal Matters with us. John Myers, the LA Times. John, let's talk about the housing bill that's expected to be reintroduced, which in a number of ways removes local control over development around transit-centric locations. What's the thought about the incoming governor's view on this?
I think you're going to hear a lot about housing. I would have argued a few weeks ago even that housing would be the number one the number one topic that we would hear out of the legislature in 2019. I think wildfires have eclipsed that for obvious reasons, but I think we're going to hear a lot about housing because people don't feel as though the work was done, was completed last year. There were important steps towards some limited funding. This is a big one, though, Larry. This proposal, which fizzled last year, and this lawmaker from San Francisco bringing it back, says we've got to incentivize more apartments, more dense housing around transit, around the metro stations in Los Angeles, around subway, the BART stations in the Bay Area. And this is, as you set it up a moment ago, a central debate about local state control. Who has the upper hand? Who should have the upper hand in making these decisions when there is such a housing crisis in so many parts of the state? I think this is one bill. I think we're going to see several more. And I think the governor-elect talked about it during the campaign, and I think it's going to be really fascinating to see what he rolls out with in January about housing. I know he has talked to a lot of people around Sacramento. He's got a group of a kitchen cabinet, as I call it, people who have advised him on the issue. I'm going to be really curious to see whether he lines up and agrees that the state has a larger role, which I should point out would be interesting for a former mayor, but we'll see what happens next year.
Yeah, and certainly there's plenty of controversy around Scott Wiener's bill because, I mean, sort of predicated on the notion that having more development around transit hubs means more people will ride public transit. That's an assertion that there are people that take issue with that. There's also the gentrification aspect of that, because typically those denser transit-oriented properties are ones that come with, you know, big rents, big price tags, and there are people nearby concerned about what that does to their community. So this can be fascinating to see how the politics of this play out, John.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, when you look at the supporters of an effort like this, Larry, they will say they hear all that, but the state has a multi-million home deficit. 3.5 million is the number quoted by Scott Wiener, the Democrat from San Francisco, pushing this particular thing. And, you know, as he said to our reporter yesterday, we have to be bold in solving the problem. They've got to think differently about this. And so these are hard conversations about what it means to for quality of life in California, what the future of California looks like. It's a good policy debate. I don't know where it's going to land, but I think it's probably a very good policy debate for lawmakers to have, to think around the corner, so to speak, as they come back here in January.
All right. And just in closing, Laurel, I wanted to ask you about the composition beyond your party of the state legislature. Where do we stand in terms of the number of women and representatives of different racial and ethnic communities? Is this a historically diverse legislature?
Well, it's really interesting. I would say the ethnic mix of legislators isn't tremendously different this session than it's been in the past. We, you know, still have kind of majority of members are white, but about a quarter are Latino, and 12% are Asian American, and about 8% are African American. Those numbers are, you know, minor differences from the last couple of sessions previously, but where we really do see an enormous change is in the representation of women. And there's 10 more women in the legislature at the beginning of this session than there were at this time 2 years ago when the last legislative class was sworn in. And that's a sizable increase. There's a total of 36 women in the legislature this session, and the high point was a total of 37. So we're almost at the kind of most that there's ever been.
High water mark, yeah.
But the reality is women still only make up 30% of the entire legislature, so still far below where women are in society at large.
Laurel, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Laurel Rosenhall of Cal Matters, John Myers of the Los Angeles Times. John, thank you as well. Good to have you both with us. As we talk about the brand new Sacramento legislative session just underway this week up to the north. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, a settlement reached between UC Berkeley and conservative groups over conservative speakers brought to campus. Conservatives have claimed that their speakers weren't treated equitably. We'll talk about what's come out of the settlement in 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later, we'll talk about an organization, a website that is establishing itself to be the repository of hacked data. We'll talk about what that means for privacy advocates who are deeply concerned about it, and for scholars who'd actually like to have access to the trove of hacked information that's out there, whether it came from Anonymous or from WikiLeaks or other sources. We'll talk about that coming up. First, we start with a settlement that was reached between UC Berkeley and conservative groups over conservative speakers on the Cal campus. Both sides claiming victory coming out of the settlement. Bobby Gelko, courts reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, joins us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
So what are the terms of the settlement between the two sides?
The settlement, which was announced yesterday, includes guarantees by the university that it will not base its security fees or the location of the speaker, that is close to the center of campus or far away, or during the prime time in the afternoon or late in the evening, based on the viewpoint of the speaker. Now, the university says they've never done that. The conservative groups, the Young America's Foundation and the Berkeley College Republicans say, yes, you have, maybe not explicitly, but tacitly, and that's why our speakers can't get decent forums on this campus. And in part to substantiate conservatives' claim of a victory here, the university agreed to pay them $70,000 in attorney's fees. That's not much in the usual realm of attorney's fees. And in fact, as the university points out, it's a good deal less than it would have cost to actually defend this case in court. But it generally means the suit has accomplished something. What it seems to have accomplished for the most part is to get the university to publicly state these are our policies on location and security costs. We won't charge you for holding a talk in a classroom. We won't charge you for holding a talk in the student union. We will charge you some security fees if you go to the big performance hall on campus called Zellerbach Hall. We've always done that. So I think what basically happened was the university made a public written commitment to policies that it says it's basically always had. Most of the charges of the discrimination and viewpoint, that is, sending conservative speakers Ann Coulter and David Horowitz.
Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah, Milo Yiannopoulos is a little different story because Milo Yiannopoulos was supposed to speak at Berkeley in February of 2017, and the so-called Antifa group took over what was mostly a peaceful demonstration, started breaking windows and the like. And basically, the UC Berkeley police plucked Milo Yiannopoulos out of there to protect him, and his speech was canceled. Later on, he scheduled an appearance at what the conservatives described as, quote, Free Speech Week, which is kind of an ironic commentary on the home of the free speech movement. That was September of last year. It wound up being a brief talk to a few people. But yeah, this amounts to a statement of the campus's policies, a public statement of the campus's policies on where we're going to host speakers. We're not going to charge them extra because they're controversial. We're not going to even charge them extra because some audience members might respond to them being controversial. The only thing that we will charge is security costs for certain buildings, and we will do it, you know, ideologically neutrally.
Okay, so even if someone is a charged speaker that they're worried it's going to get out significant numbers of people that need to be, you know, dealt with security, that extra cost will not be borne by the conservative sponsors?
Exactly.
Okay.
The university says that's what we do now. The conservatives say, no, it's not, but basically they are now having to declare it.
Okay.
As official policy.
San Francisco Chronicle reporter Bob Gelko with us. Also with us, Associate General Counsel for Young America's Foundation, which brought suit against Berkeley, Mark Trammell. Ms. Trammell, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we have the university that says this is this settlement upheld what we've been doing all along. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think this is more than a public statement. What we see here are serious policy changes that resulted in our lawsuit and our subsequent settlement agreement. I mean, first of all, the university is paying Young America's Foundation $70,000 here in the settlement. Secondly, the security fees policy is 100% different than it was before. When the university brought Sonia Sotomayor to speak in Zellerbach Hall to a full capacity of 2,000 students, they only charged $5,000 in security. Yet when we tried to bring Ben Shapiro in the same auditorium, it was going to cost three times that much. There's a long history of disparate treatment as it pertains to security fees. And as a result of the lawsuit, that's going to be no longer. There will be no security fees at UC Berkeley unless, I think there's a small caveat here, unless there's a transaction taking place, there's money changing hands like at a ticket stand before you'd enter the auditorium, or if there's, I think, alcohol on the premises. I think those are the two carve-outs. But in general, there will be no more of these disparate security fee assessments.
So if I'm understanding you correct, you're saying that UC Berkeley will not charge any security fee, or just that they'll charge a uniform security fee?
No, the fee schedule, it's posted as Exhibit B in the settlement agreement. The fee schedule is very clear that the security fee will be $0 in cases such as ours. You know, whether we bring David Horowitz or Ben Shapiro or Ann Coulter, it doesn't matter. It's going to be a $0 security fee.
Do you see this having any impact on other colleges and universities when it comes to what might be unpopular conservative speakers?
Well, I hope so. I hope it will. And I think it should. You know, I think Berkeley has always been a school that's looked to and prided itself in free speech. And honestly, I commend the university for what it's done here in agreeing to the settlement and making serious policy changes that will usher in a new generation of free speech at Berkeley. So I do hope that other schools look at this. I think what Berkeley has implemented here as a result of our settlement are objective standards to apply. And that's the crux of it. When universities are assessing security fees based on subjectivity, there's room for abuse. It becomes very problematic. You get viewpoint discrimination issues that are involved. But if they can apply objective standards, then we can avoid those issues altogether.
Now, the initial lawsuit a federal judge dismissed, it looked like this might have been a tough filing for you to prevail. What led you to believe that you had a chance of actually winning this had it gone to court?
Well, I would just say the initial filing, having a case dismissed without prejudice, is really not it's really not out of the ordinary. What would have been out of the ordinary would have been for the case to have been dismissed with prejudice. But that's not what the judge did. The judge said, look, at this motion to dismiss phase, we're looking not at the merits of the policy. We're looking to see whether your complaint is well pleaded and that enough facts have been asserted that we can move forward to a trial. So the judge allowed us to amend the complaint, which we did. And then when the judge reheard that motion to dismiss, the judge denied in part that motion and allowed our suit to move forward, which I think is what created a significant amount of leverage for the settlement that we celebrate today.
We're talking with Mark Trammell, counsel for Young America's Foundation, which brought the suit against UC Berkeley over what the group claimed was unequal treatment of conservative speakers to ones that were progressive or at least not controversial as the conservative speakers were. Also with us, reporter at the news site Berkeley Side, which is based in Berkeley, Natalie Orenstein. Ms. Orenstein, what's the response on campus, or is there any, to the settlement?
If this had happened in 2017, I think the response would be a little bit louder. This lawsuit came in the middle of a series of public tensions that played out in the form of protests on campus and that bled out into the streets of Berkeley. I think a lot of people have sort of forgotten about that. You know, students are, there's a lot of turnover among students. This year, there haven't been many or really any of these big public controversial events. So this announcement came a little bit quietly on campus.
All right. And do you think, you know, given how you read this settlement, you anticipate it's going to lead to changes in the types of speakers coming to campus?
It's hard to say. You know, I wanted to clear one thing as well. There's another caveat to this $0 security fee schedule. Certain big venues that were central in some of these controversies, like Zellerbach Hall, can still set their own fees. And I think the university will certainly be more conscious of the potential outcry or response to those fees. So everyone will be paying closer attention to how those play out. But it is possible that certain, you know, business as usual will continue as well.
So the venues are not under the control of the university then?
Certain venues that do ticketing and such separately. Most venues where these speaking events take place are, you know, are part of the central campus. And so those, the security schedule, the new, that was part of the settlement, applies to most of the venues on campus, but certain larger venues are outside of that purview.
All right. I want to thank you. That's Natalie Orenstein from Berkeley side, the Independent News side, Bobby Gelko, San Francisco Chronicle reporter, and Mark Trammell, Young America's Foundation. Coming up on Air Talk, we'll discuss a new website, very controversial, a repository of leaked data. Might be a boon to researchers, to future scholars, but what does it mean to personal privacy? We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, got all kinds of interesting conversation, including the future of Tejon Ranch. That's that massive housing development in the Tejon Pass along Interstate 5. The question is, will the L.A. County Board of Supervisors give it final approval? With concerns about wildfire vulnerability with developments that are in that rural-urban interface, as the Tejon Ranch project is. We'll talk about that coming up in the second hour. But first, we're going to talk about, with all the different data breaches and hacking that's gone on, does it make sense that there be a web-based repository of all that hacked data? Well, a website titled Distributed Denial of Secrets is designed to be a collective distribution system for leaked and hacked data. It launched yesterday morning. Joining us to talk about it is Emma Best, a Boston-based member of the collective behind the Distributed Denial of Secrets. Ms. Best, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the rationale for having a website that has all this hacked data?
Well, a lot of the data is very hard to access for most people, or they don't know where to find it, and it has a tendency to disappear over time, which means that we lose valuable historical tools for exploring our own past, as well as reconstructing the cases. So we wanted to provide a safe way for people to be able to find it, to store it, and to enable people to come forward and leak or share sensitive materials that they might, for whatever reason, hesitate to do so directly. Whistleblowers often have difficulty finding ways to share large amounts of data.
And what's the gatekeeping that's involved to protect personal privacy, if there is, or things that might do financial or reputational harm to individuals?
Right now, our basic method with that is we are restricting access to certain data sets. I think right now it's about 15 or 16 data sets that are set for limited distribution. People can contact us directly to request access, but they need to explain who they are, why they need the information, and what they're going to do with it. Because we want academics and researchers and journalists to be able to get to it. And there's a lot of uses for data that we can't predict ahead of time. There's been some interesting studies using the Ashley Madison data that I think would have been very difficult to imagine in advance. But because the information can be sensitive and it can have, in some cases, social security numbers, credit card numbers, and other personal identifying information, there's no reason to further distribute that and put that into everyone's hands. Long term, we plan to make some of these data sets available in a sanitized format where we'll try and remove the member information and put forward the safe information that we can so that people can go through it at their leisure. But the things that might cause undue headaches for people, that's going to be a lot more limited. You know, academics should be able to access that if they can explain why. But for the most part, I don't need to be giving people Henry Kissinger's old credit card number.
Yeah. For journalists, for example, who might want it for background on their reporting, what would be the threshold of legitimacy for your organization to allow access to someone who calls her himself a journalist?
Well, it's hard to say dealing with just hypotheticals, and we take it all on a case-by-case basis. Essentially, though, we would seek to verify their identity and find out what system they were going to use to process the data. If they were a journalist, what publisher would they be using? If they're an academic, for instance, would we be able to communicate briefly with their appropriate ethics review board? So the details vary depending very strongly on what the data is and what the claimed purpose is. But our goal is to not give it to anyone who we can't verify. That's the absolute minimum threshold, is if we can't confirm who someone is, then we simply would not give them the data, because that just seems an unnecessary risk.
You're part of a collective behind distributed denial of secrets. What do you and your colleagues who are part of the collective have in common? What's the background you represent, or the mission that you see yourselves following here?
We're transparency activists, journalists, and archivists who want to make sure that the information is preserved and available to the people who need it. A lot of this stuff just tends to disappear, and we were tired of seeing it no longer be available to the people who truly needed it most.
Emma Best of the collective behind Distributed Denial of Secrets, a site that launched yesterday. Also with us from Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, Associate Professor of Media and Communications Lisa Lynch. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you see as the potential value of a site like this that has hacked data?
Well, it really depends on, the data. I do see the advantage of having kind of a centralized port of access and something that remains stable over time. I would say that for a lot of the hacked data that I've, like for the Ashley Madison data, for example, a lot of that data has been kind of spread around on the internet and kind of discovered piecemeal by scientists. Data scientists and infidelity researchers. If you're interested in doing research on data sets like this, it could be a valuable resource, provided that the researchers and journalists were, as Emma has described, kind of, vetted. And provided that enough redaction is done on any data that kind of hits the public. I guess my curiosity here is, what's the balance here? A lot of the between kind of data that has a kind of political or civic or governmental or legal interest and data that is, you know, primarily either personal or consumer facing data. I tried to get on the site earlier, and actually I was having some problems getting a connection. So I'm not quite sure what's in the current archive now and how that works out.
All right. We'll also talk about how this will be paid for, because obviously you're talking about labor costs to redact certain documents and to vet people who are requesting access to the site, Distributed Denial of Secrets. Emma Best with us from the site, Lisa Lynch, professor at Drew University. And coming up, we'll talk with consumer advocate John Simpson. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And if you have questions for our trio of guests, our lines open at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. Yesterday saw the launch of a new online site, Distributed Denial of Secrets, to serve as an archive of whistleblower data, hack data that scholars, the journalists would be able to access, so it's not lost from research uses going forward. But of course, that raises concerns about gatekeeping, privacy matters as well. And with us, consumer advocate for Consumer Watchdog here in Southern California, John Simpson. John, thank you for joining us. What do you think about the idea of having this sort of a repository?
Well, it's difficult to know, because I haven't been able to get into it either. I keep getting a message, Tor 2 web error. So I don't know what if they're trying to do it through the Tor system for more security or something like it. But in any event, I can't get into it. I am concerned about having a place where lots of really truly personal information would be kept. And who would get access to that? I think it's completely appropriate for things like, you know, the Snowden revelations about NSA that got leaked and got out. That's great. And a lot of what WikiLeaks does, that's great. But this sounds to me like there's not enough concern being given to truly private information that should not be available to anyone.
And how would you go if you wanted to have that sort of information available for historians and researchers? How would you do that ethically and protect individuals?
I'm not sure that my credit card number and my passwords should be of interest to anyone else. And from what I understand, some of that information potentially would be on this site. Maybe we need to have a clearer understanding of everything that's going to be there. But are they going to, for instance, put up the most recent Marriott hacked information? That should not be made available. Period.
Emma Best, first of all, you want to respond to the status of the website and the difficulty our two guests have had getting onto it.
So there are two addresses for the website, and performance is always going to be best through Tor browser. The DDoSSecrets.com address redirects you to a Tor to web portal, which makes it visible to people who are using a regular browser. But that uses a midpoint to translate and make the information go to a regular Chrome or Firefox browser that we don't control. So that sometimes goes down. If you put the address into a Tor browser, it will redirect you towards the actual domain, which is just a normal onion URL that begins with DDoS secrets. The site itself is up and stable, and people should always use the Tor browser to access it whenever possible. The other address is just a secondary thing that we offer as a general convenience and a way for people to remember the address of the website.
Your response to John Simpson's point about, you know, what is the research value of average citizens' social security numbers and credit card data that may be hacked, such as in the Marriott Hotels incident recently?
Well, first of all, we don't really seek out data sets that consist solely of that unless they were sufficiently high profile enough to just warrant conserving for historical value, like some of the LulzSec hacks, including the Sony data. In terms of the credit card numbers, Social Security numbers, I have a hard time imagining what the historical value of that would be. And that's why we're asking that any historians or academics that think there is value in that be able to explain and justify to us exactly what that is. But we're not going to simply assume ahead of time that we can safely and permanently rule out every potential use for data in numerous fields that we're not experts in. Like I said before, the Ashley Madison data, people would have been hard-pressed, I think, to predict some of the studies that came about because of that. But yeah, concerns are real, which is why we're not posting the credit card numbers or the Social Security numbers where anyone can access them. And I agree, if we received a copy of the Marriott data, we might make that available to specific security researchers or, you know, any journalist that could explain why they might need to look at that specifically.
Would you house anything that's provided to you? Are there certain things you'd say just preemptively, we see no value to this, only potential for security vulnerability. We're not going to host it here. Emma?
The only thing that comes to mind immediately in terms of material that we wouldn't accept would be things like Joshua Schulte's hard drive, because while that might have a lot of data that would be very relevant to understanding the CIA leak and things involving WikiLeaks, there's also things like the child pornography, which under no circumstances would we willingly host or distribute or preserve.
John Simpson of Consumer Watchdog, does that provide any solace to you?
Well, I have concerns about my legitimate personal information that I think I have control over, then being stolen, and then being made available. And that, I think, is what you're suggesting that you would do. And the only caveat to it would be, well, if I come in and make a good case, I might have to make a good case that I need that information. But I just think that in digital age, there are things that people should continue to have control over, and how it's used, and whether it is used for some other purpose than what the information was provided for.
Professor Lynch of Drew University, quick closing comment from you on this topic. What are you hopeful will come from distributed denial of secrets, the site coming up?
Well, I just want to quickly give an example that might illuminate what Emma is referring about. For example, with the Ashley Madison data, someone did a study and found that 40,000 women in that database were using 6 email addresses, in other words, between them or among them. So by looking at what we might think of as personal information, they were actually able to uncover this kind of pattern of, I guess, fraud in the Ashley Madison database. So I think Emma's right. We can't really assume that the information that's in this archive isn't going to have some use.
Okay.
Issue is adjudicating the use.
I appreciate it. That's Professor Lisa Lynch, Drew University, Emma Best of the Distributed Denial of Secrets site, and John Simpson of Consumer Watchdog. More to come in the second hour of Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. It's a very poignant scene at the rotunda at the U.S. Capitol. Bob Dole came in, was brought in his wheelchair, former senator, of course, and presidential candidate, and he was helped out of his wheelchair and saluted before the casket of George H.W. Bush. Very poignant scene taking place just a few minutes ago at the nation's capital. And as Hetty just mentioned, we will have live coverage from NPR of the funeral of George H.W. Bush, the 41st American president. The funeral will come your way from Washington National Cathedral, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning right here on KPCC. Well, next week, the L.A. County Board of Supervisors takes up final approval of the very big Tejon Ranch Centennial Project. It is a housing development that would build 19,000 homes. This, of course, in a Southern California that is desperately in need of additional housing. However, it's constructed in what's often referred to as an urban wildlands interface, where wildfires are cause for concern. So as the Los Angeles Times story this morning raises this issue and Nina Agrawal's story, might the supervisors be a bit concerned given the historically devastating wildfires in Northern and Southern California? Joining us is Char Miller, Pomona College Professor of Environmental Analysis and History. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thanks so much, Larry. I'm glad to be with you.
So what are your concerns about a development of this scale, this size, in an area like this?
Well, you know, I think part of the dilemma, obviously, post-Paradise and the Woolsey Fire and every other fire that we've seen over the last decade or two is recognizing the tremendous relationship, the really tight link between where we build houses and where fires erupt. We call them wildland fires, but really they are fundamentally generated by and thus threaten the very communities that we have all sort of streaked out to live in. So the first is, you know, sort of the fact that we're building in the wildfire zone that CAL FIRE has indicated in various spots on this particular plot of land is high severity or extremely high severity fire possibilities. And so part of, you know, if I'm one of the commissioners, after the fire in Butte took out Paradise, I think I might be asking myself some questions about a community that, however well planned, and let's give Tejon developers credit, they've really planned this very carefully. It doesn't matter how well it's planned.
Have we had a subdivision, a large development like this, that has been built with state-of-the-art fire protection? I mean, I'm thinking of that area of Santa Rosa, for example, that was wiped out. I don't know what. I don't think it was a very old neighborhood, though.
No, it wasn't.
Do we have anything comparable to what Centennial would be building?
No, Centennial is quite unique in its development processes, in the long-standing arguments about what it would look like, and in its compromises to sort of make better, and in its size. I mean, that's the thing that really, after Paradise, that was one of the first things I started thinking about is we're building 19,000 houses, let's say roughly 60,000 people possibly could be living there. What if, in a catastrophic way, a fire went ripping through that neighborhood, could they all get out? And my guess is that, like Paradise, that wouldn't happen because we can't know where the fire is going to come from and whether those evacuation routes, however well planned, will actually be utilized.
We're talking with Pomona College Professor Char Miller, Professor of Environmental Analysis and History, also with us from Tejon Ranch Company, which is developing the Centennial Project, VP of Corporate Communications, Barry Zoeller. Barry, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
You bet, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So share with us what sort of fire mitigations are planned in Centennial.
Well, there are a number of them, and I think there are certain questions that it's appropriate for the LA County Board of Supervisors to ask. And we also have to start with the given that the Board of Supervisors have already approved the location where Centennial is planned for development. And it is right that it is currently listed as a high fire hazard area, but that is primarily due to the fact that there is some great distance between the nearest fire station and where Centennial will be located. Of course, that will be mitigated by the fact that Centennial will have four fire stations within the community, which not only will provide fire protection for Centennial itself, but will extend that fire protection to other communities in the Antelope Valley that are adjacent to Centennial. It will be built like neighborhoods in Santa Clarita, Stevenson Ranch, Valencia, which I think answered the question that you asked previously about other communities built to these standards. How have they withstood fire events? And I think those communities are great examples of how you can plan for and mitigate as much as you can against fire. And I think we also have to realize, Larry, that you can plan to do your very, very best. We describe it as making Centennial as fireproof as possible. But you can have unforeseen circumstances in a rural environment and an urban-rural interface, and even within a downtown area. You know, look at the devastating fire that occurred at the apartment building in London. Look at other fires in urban areas. And what you need to do is just plan your very best to be able to prevent such an occurrence and then defend against such an occurrence.
I think the concern...
We saw that most recently up in Anchorage. Look at the difference of building codes and planning for an earthquake with the result of that 7.0 earthquake last week compared to what happened decades before.
No, all fair points about the preparation and mitigation, but it seems to me one of the things we've seen in these catastrophic fires of the past couple of years is the speed at which they move, the fire load in the surrounding area, climate change, some people believe, is associated with this, and that is going to intensify fires going forward. So the question is, even with four fire stations, with using state-of-the-art fire-resistant technology for roofing and the like for homes, are you going to be able to deal with the threat moving forward, given what we've recently seen?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think it's really, to a certain extent, comparing apples and oranges, looking at the terrain where Centennial is located compared to the terrain with the campfire in Paradise, or even with the Woolsey fire in Malibu and also in the Thousand Oaks area. Centennial is very much different. It is a site that has been grazed by cattle for 150 years, and cattle will continue to graze there. It is relatively flat. Doesn't have the steep canyons and the extensive mound of chaparral. It doesn't have extensive tree coverage, and where the trees are currently located are in an open space area to the far northwest portion of the community. So by and large, you have a flat community with low fuel load, with plenty of defensible space around it, bisected by the California Aqueduct, and then also then ribboned on the southern edge by Highway 138, which will be expanded to three lanes in each direction, then with close proximity to Interstate 5 and a number of different connections to all of those. So, yes, I think you can plan.
You're saying you think you can evacuate. You think the fuel load is not as
fire risk.
Yeah. All right. John Miller, your response to those points.
Those are all great protections, and let's applaud them for the work that they have done. It is, as Barry had suggested, there are always unforeseen events, and I think post-Paradise, post-Woolsey, post-Thomas fires, it is, in fact, the unexpected things that happened that have blown our minds and created the loss of extraordinary amounts of property, let alone human beings. From my vantage point, I'd be very nervous as a commissioner. But as Barry also said, this is well along in the process. So I've got two bets, the first of which is the commissions will, in fact, support this development. And the second of which is, unfortunately, at some point, we're going to be back on the show commiserating over the consequences of a grassland fire, and grasslands fire burn up there frequently, and they're very fast and tough to control. And we'll begin to wonder once again why we did what we did, even though the company has done the extraordinary work that it has done in advance, hoping to mitigate risk.
And as a practical matter, where else, if you're looking to build 19,000 homes,
sure,
where else are you going to put them than in this interface between the urban and rural area?
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the high dilemmas that, we face as a broader region. We need affordable housing. This isn't going to be exactly that. We need less commuting, and this isn't going to stop that either. We need people out of their cars. This is going to accelerate that process. There are a lot of other elements to this story that I think also in their way contribute to the larger dilemmas, because the only way out of there is on roads, and therefore the only way out of there is on cars. And as we saw up in camp, in the campfire, let alone all the other fires recently, being in a car is not exactly the best place when fire is erupting. But again, you know, this is tough. We have to build houses. We have to build homes. We don't necessarily have to build houses. And you know, we have done this repeatedly since the Hollywood Hills and the Beverly Hills. And every time we've done it, fire has erupted.
All right. We're talking with Pomona College Professor Char Miller, Professor of Environmental Analysis and History, Barry Zoeller of Tejon Ranch Company, VP of Corporate Communication and Investor Relations. Tejon Ranch is building the Centennial Development, final approval from the L.A. County Board of Supervisors, scheduled for a vote next week. Barry, wanted to ask you about insurance because of the high fire rating of this area. Will there be any difficulty with homeowners there getting insurance?
Well, I can't speak specifically to that, Larry, because it will be some time before homes will actually be constructed at Centennial. And by that time, there will be plenty of fire stations already developed. So the classification may be reduced from its current fire hazard classification. So it's something that I can't address what the insurance will be at the time. I would like to speak to what the professor indicated, which would be the inevitability of a discussion over some consequence of a fire. And, you know, I think that's an unfortunate and perhaps an unrealistic prognostication, and we certainly hope nothing happens like that. You know, I can share with you just anecdotally, I have been with Tejon Ranch for 15 years, and in my 15 years here, I have never seen a wildfire within the Centennial development. According to the county documents, from 1964 to 2015, that's a period of 50 years, there were 31 wildfires or 31 grass fires within 5 miles of Centennial and only 4 within the project's boundaries. And I think that speaks to the long-standing practice of having cattle on the property, having it grazed, and so the fuel load is low. And when it is developed and when there are cattle still grazing around the perimeter of the property, plus all the planning that goes into it, you present this defensible space around the community and within the community as well.
I want to, Barry, just throw a quick curveball. A number of listeners have raised the point that the San Andreas Fault is very close to the Tejon Pass and into this project. What are you doing to mitigate potential effects of a catastrophic earthquake?
Well, we do everything that anyone else would do in Southern California, any place where you live in close proximity to some sort of fault. Even though the San Andreas has a particularly infamous name, there have been plenty of other destructive earthquakes throughout California. So you plan for it, you move buildings away from it, you make sure that the building codes are such to be able to withstand seismic activity, et cetera.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us. Barry Zoeller of Tejon Ranch Company, building the Centennial development in the Tejon Pass, north of Los Angeles, right between the Central Valley and the Los Angeles Basin. Char Miller, Professor of Environmental Analysis and History at Pomona College, with us as well. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, a big case before the California Supreme Court tomorrow that has to do with the California rule, as it's known, about whether current public employees can have their pension benefits changed by state or local governments. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. Big day at the California Supreme Court tomorrow as they hear a case related to state firefighters and changes in their pension plan, changes that were made during Governor Jerry Brown's administration. The case is expected to get at what's known as the California rule, a rule that in previous court decisions makes it difficult for the pension terms of public employees to be changed while they're employed by a state or local government. With us is University of Minnesota School of Law professor Amy B. Monahan, who's written extensively about the California rule and its limits on public employee pension reform. Professor Monahan, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So describe for us what this rule is and just briefly how courts have upheld the notion of it.
Sure. So the rule developed through a series of judicial opinions, really beginning in the early 1900s, sort of the most current statement of it came from a 1950s case. And to summarize it, it basically held that pensions are considered contractual as of an employee's first day of employment. And after that, no detrimental changes could be made. So there are a couple of sort of notable things about it. One is that the protection comes from judicial opinions rather than a state constitutional provision or statutory law, and it's highly protective, right? It protects both what someone's already accrued and has been interpreted to also protect the right to future accruals.
So in other words, if the terms of you start working for a public entity, whatever the pension benefits are at that time of employment, your employer, that public entity, is not free to change those terms so long as you stayed employed by that entity.
Correct.
And in those court decisions, how does the court differentiate that that's a right versus privately employed individuals whose companies can change the terms of a pension at will?
Right. So the biggest difference is that when we're talking about state and local employees, it's entirely a matter of state law. So for private employers, there's a federal law that governs the protection for pension benefits. And the federal law is very clear about what is protected and what isn't. And of course, there's also insurance at the federal level in case your employer runs out of money in the pension plan. So at the state level, it's basically up to the state to decide. One of the things that makes this area of law unusual, it used to be the case that pensions were held to be gratuities, meaning, just as it sounds, gifts. And if you label something a gift, it's not entitled to any protection at all. So we went from a time really in the early 1900s where you could change pensions at any time for any reason, right? So someone could be retired and you could take it away. California was really one of the first states to hold that that wasn't correct as a legal matter, that they saw it as a contractual relationship between employer and employee, right? When you go to work, the employer is saying, if you work for us, we'll pay you this salary and this pension benefit. And if you accept our offer, that pension becomes legally protected.
And that could be changed through collective bargaining, but not unilaterally.
Correct. And it varies from state to state, but in California, my understanding is it's quite unusual for pensions to be subject to collective bargaining. Retiree medical benefits might be, but usually pensions are offered through statutory law, so state law.
All right. Amy Monahan, University of Minnesota law professor, who's written about the California rule that is related to a case to be heard tomorrow by the California Supreme Court. Also with us, the president of California Pension Reform, an advocacy group that would like to see a reduction in the obligations, pension obligations of public entities, Dan Pellissier. Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us. What is the significance of tomorrow's court case to this issue?
Well, first of all, thank you, Larry, for having me on. You know, tomorrow's a really important day for California's state and local governments in that it hopefully will provide a roadmap out of the unsustainable costs that are being imposed upon these government agencies by their pension obligations. Right now, the pension plans are, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars underfunded using the fund's own calculations, and the payments required to meet those unfunded liabilities are going up and up, and it's putting a huge burden on government agencies. And, a good ruling on the California rule will allow the government agencies to go back to the employees and negotiate changes in the pension benefits that could save the defined benefit pension plans and improve the security of the retirement finances for most of the government employees.
And this particular case had to do with a law that eliminated so-called airtime, where employees could buy extra years of service that then would be credited to their pensions, even though they didn't work those additional years. State of California did away with that airtime, which is now being challenged by a firefighter group. So this would really determine then whether the state has that latitude. Also with us is Terry Brennan, who's Director of Revenue, Budget, and Pensions at SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which represents 700,000 California public employees. Thank you, Terry, for being with us. How important is tomorrow's case to your organization?
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. It really depends on the ruling as to how important it is. I think Dan and his ilk and supporters believe that this is an opportunity to overturn over 100 years of precedent in California regarding contracts. It could actually be settled on much narrower and much simpler grounds. Even if they agreed with the state of California and eliminated airtime, it wouldn't save a dime. Airtime was a revenue neutral transaction to state and local agencies that participated in it. So making it go away doesn't save any money. It just damages the retirement of some public employees.
But it's still the principle of whether the state has the right to make those changes in its pension offerings, correct?
Correct. I think the decision, and Amy's probably a better resource for this than either Dan or I, but they could rule that is in fact not a vested right and therefore not protected under the California rule.
All right. We have a listener
in the California rule, per se,
who joins us, Santa Monica's city manager. He's also the former mayor of Pasadena, Rick Cole. Rick, thank you for being with us. Appreciate your calling in to give a city perspective on this. What do you see as the significance of tomorrow's case?
Well, Larry, the biggest problem of the unfunded liabilities facing both the state and localities is the sweetening of pension formulas actually after people took their jobs. So it wasn't something they signed up for on day one, but when pension formulas were improved in the period just before the dot-com bubble burst, they were granted retroactively to everyone, whether they've been there a day or 20 years, and no funding was put aside to fund that. And that's really the source of the big hole, along with the losses that were suffered in the Great Recession. So changing the California rule would allow local governments to belatedly fix a problem that really has no other solution.
Your response to that, Terry Brennan?
Well, the initial premise that this is one of the biggest problems was the enhanced formulas. We, in fact, know what the cost of that was. It's been paid over several times. In fact, the cause of this was losing $6 trillion in the market. When 61% of the cost of your pensions comes from stock market earnings, and the market tanks twice from 2000 to 2013, and we lose $6 trillion in assets, that's why we have to make these additional contributions to make up for those losses.
Rick, you want to respond to that?
It's a great soundbite, but it doesn't hold water. It's not sustainable.
It's actually a—
Hold on. Rick, go ahead.
It's not sustainable for someone to retire at age 50 with 90% of their income for the rest of their life, along with survivor benefits, if they live to be 75, 85, or 95. We never could afford those benefits, and we certainly couldn't afford them by granting them retroactively.
All right. Rick Cole, city manager of Santa Monica, joining us on Air Talk. Let me go back to Dan Pelissier of California Pension Reform. If California's the California rule ends up being struck down by the state high court, what do you anticipate is going to be the response from local governments?
Well, I think that local governments will have an opportunity to negotiate. And some will be probably successful with some of their unions, and may not be as successful with others. Up to this point, the unions have not had to negotiate because they felt that the California rule protected their future earnings. But we're on an unsustainable path. The costs are just going up and up, and we have to have relief. And the court has a great opportunity to signal that it's time to adjust the benefits that have been offered. It's interesting that Terry raised the issue of airtime being cost neutral for government agencies, and that actually was not the case. CalPERS and other agencies grossly underestimated the cost of the airtime benefits, and they spent a lot of money on it. And that is why statutes, and I would certainly defer to Professor Monahan, but that's why statutes should not be viewed as contracts, because the circumstances under which you pass a statute may change in the future, and you may need to adjust it. And if you view benefits as immutable contracts for the life of the employee, it doesn't provide the flexibility to future legislatures to make changes when the circumstances they initially anticipated, come out much.
Terry Brennan of SEIU, your response to that?
Well, I actually believe that it is a contractual agreement. From the first day my members go to work, they deduct out of their paycheck money to contribute to a benefit they may not see for 30 years. I know the city manager talked about retiring at 50. In fact, that's so rare, it's obscene. In fact, the typical retirement for a safety member is age 57. For a miscellaneous member, it's 62 or older. So this myth of, six-figure retirements at age 50 is way overstated and overblown. The average retirement is $3,000 a month.
Yeah, but you've got a lot of retirees who were making much lower salaries years ago, so that's skewing that number.
Retiree last year. Last year. I'm not averaging in 15, grandmas who retired on, a few thousand dollars a month or $1,000 a month. The average, you can look it up, it's on the CalPERS website. The average school retiree is somewhere under $2,000 a month. So, this idea of putting out people with $100,000 pensions who retired at 50, it's just not happening.
Argument
for pension reform for Dan and his colleagues and billionaire funders, but it's not true.
Dan, do you take issue with that average?
Well, I think that I think the numbers are the numbers, and it's nice that they've started looking at the numbers that people have retired recently as opposed to those retired a long time ago. But none of that changes the fact that when the legislature established the airtime statute, they did not in any way signal that it was a contract. And that is what the state Supreme Court said in an Orange County case over retiree health care benefits, is that statutes can be interpreted as contracts, but there needs to be very clear message from the legislating body that they intended to form a contract. And there is nothing in the record that shows that airtime had what was guaranteed by the legislature as a contract.
All right. We've gone over that. And I thank you, Dan Pelissier, California Pension Reform, Jerry Brennan, Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and Professor Amy Monahan, University of Minnesota. Coming up, we'll talk about the challenges Sunset Magazine finds itself in. It's very intertwined with California's history, presenting an image of the West, not just to the rest of the country, but to Californians themselves, making it one of the most popular magazines in the state. We'll talk about the history of Sunset and its shaky future back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. I happened to catch an article by Meg James in the Los Angeles Times about some of the challenges Sunset Magazine is apparently going through. People have been writing for it, have described financial problems. They've moved out of their headquarters building. We invited the publisher of Sunset to join us to talk about the publication, and he declined. But I want to talk about the history and presence of Sunset Magazine, 120 years old. And really a reflection both of sort of practical living in the West. You'd see, you know, for example, how to, you know, barbecue chicken or what makes for a beautiful patio, with also a kind of mythologized romantic sense of living in California. It combined those two things. And for many of us who are native Angelenos or Californians, we grew up with it on the coffee table. It was as common to see it as Time Magazine or any other publication. With us to talk about Sunset Magazine and its history as well as its potential future, Bill Deverill, professor of history and director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. Bill, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Larry, for having me.
So I understand you, like me, you grew up with Sunset on the coffee table.
Absolutely. I grew up in Colorado, and Sunset was a staple in our house. We all read it. And I think we all anticipated its arrival.
Well, let's talk about the history. It began as a railroad publication.
Yeah, it's a vehicle of the Southern Pacific Railroad. Begins at the very tail end of the 19th century. It's highly literate. It's edited and run by a man named Paul Shoup, who eventually becomes the head of the Southern Pacific operation. And it's absolutely tied to the railroad and its future and its fortunes across the West and then into Mexico as well.
And this is at a time when the railroads are really touting rail travel for tourists and national parks and attractions of the West to try and get people to come. I guess Sunset would be to try and get people to come and settle.
Yeah, in some ways, Sunset's arc is drawing people to the West and then, over the course of the 20th century, teaching them how to live in the West. So it's, in many respects, very, very successful, I suspect, in creating that kind of juggernautic view of the American West as a place to visit and then eventually to settle.
Want to encourage you to go to our AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We have a slideshow of 10 historic Sunset Magazine covers going back to 1902 and continuing up to 1933. I'm looking at the 1902, and it's got a very I don't know what you would you call it, a Santa Claus with roses on his back, I guess exemplifying the whole notion of this land of sunshine and gardens as opposed to the Eastern notion of Christmas. And then the covers go on. You see a vaquero tending cattle in the field. You see an Indian domicile, looks like a Taos type pueblo. Much of it, Bill, has to do with Indian life in the West as well.
Well, a very stylized and romantic vision of Indian life in the American West. But remember, this is also the part of the country that the railroad cuts through. And so the railroad hotels, the railroad restaurants, those are being advertised in the early days of Sunset as places to see and take advantage of through the railroad's commerce. But yeah, the artistic quality of Sunset has always been a very, very high one, admittedly highly romanticized. But the vision of the American Southwest, and in particularly of California, as a place that is beckoning for the 20th century tourist, Sunset's probably the most important advertising vehicle of that in print.
Now, there was the Harvey houses, of course, that the Atchison, Topeka, Santa Fe had. So is Sunset kind of Southern Pacific's answer to what Santa Fe was doing?
That's a very good way to put it. I think in many respects, Sunset is the print version of Fred Harvey's operation to draw people to the American West and treat them well. And along the way to teach them how to become consumers and students of a particular vision of the American West.
We're talking with historian Bill Deverell joining us. He's at both the Huntington and USC. I welcome your calls as we talk about Sunset Magazine. I'm still a subscriber, Bill. I think you are as well. I get the hard copy of the magazine. I think my son reads it more than my wife and I, but it's there in our house every month. I'd like to hear from you, your thoughts about Sunset and the significance, particularly if you grew up here in Southern California or anywhere in the West. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. And we should mention Sunset wasn't just, you know, a niche publication. Its sales figures, Bill, it like rivaled Time Magazine or any big national publication.
There's no question, particularly after the Second World War. These magazines, what can be called shelter magazines like House Beautiful and Home and Garden, Sunset fits into that pattern. They're very, very successful because you have a rising middle class after the Second World War. You have a huge demographic explosion in the American West. And these magazines are teaching people, or at least a certain slice of people. We have to be careful. It's not aimed at everybody. They're teaching them how to live and take advantage of their surroundings in the West.
I think one of the prime demographics, the group that Kevin Starr, the historian, called the folks. These are my family, actually, came from the Midwest at the turn of the century to California for economic opportunity. It seems like, you know, a lot of those folks, white working class people who are upwardly mobile, that's who it's aimed at.
I think that's exactly right. White working class people of a generation just before and just after the Second World War, who then use home ownership and other occupational vehicles to ride into the middle class, and in doing so, gain an automobile or two, and Sunset's teaching them not only how to live in that new suburban house, but also how to transit the American West in search of recreation and leisure.
We're talking with historian Bill Deverell. Coming up, we'll talk with Ken Doctor, media analyst, who joins us frequently to talk about the state of American newspapers. Ken's going to talk with us about the challenge of a regional publication like Sunset. Is the Los Angeles Times report, Sunset going through some what appear to be economic challenges, downsizing, moving out of its longtime headquarters. We'll talk with Ken about the challenges for a publication like this, particularly since the physical magazine is so much a part of what Sunset is, and even other publications have a hard time converting to digital dominance. What about something that, you know, its look of it, the feel of it, is part of its appeal? We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. I always love talking with Bill Deverell because we just go on and on talking California history. He's the authority, and I'm certainly interested as a third generation Angeleno, my son, fourth generation. We're talking about Sunset Magazine, 120-year-old guide to Western living and California. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Ding in Pasadena. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much, Larry. The Garden Book. What about the wonderful old Garden Book, which no gardener in California could do without?
Boy, that is so true. It's an, and every household that had any garden of any size had a Sunset Garden Book.
Sunset Garden Books, Sunset Deck Books. There's no question that publishing imprint that had the brand of Sunset Magazine on could reach far and wide through those other books about gracious living in the American West.
Ding, thanks. Appreciate your being with it. Yeah, would even have different, you know, climates, microclimates based on where you were in the American West. Ken Doctor, media analyst, Newsonomics is his site, and the book that he did several years ago, looking at the future of news consumption. Ken, appreciate your joining us.
Sure.
What kind of a future do you think a regional publication like Sunset has?
Well, it's a declining future. They are one of the many, many legacy publications that have just failed to transition themselves. And we see this so widely in the magazine business as well as the newspapers that we've talked about over the years. I just looked at the latest statistics, and they're still at, because I think the three of us on the phone are among the subscribers, but there's still a million one print subscribers. There's a lot of people. But we're paying a low price for that publication, for Sunset. On the digital side, they have only sold 16,000 digital subscriptions. So you can see that for the magazines that have transitioned, they're selling lots and lots, and the newspapers, they're selling lots and lots of digital subscriptions, and they're relying more and more on readers and not advertisers. Sunset failed to do that when it was under the Time Inc. ownership. And then when Time Inc. sold it, we've had plainly an incompetent new owner. And there is not a good plan that we know about to revive it. So it is a part of what we're seeing very widely in the magazine business. And interestingly, the magazines that are actually transitioning are relatively few. And they're the kind of thought leaders, the kind of New Yorker and Atlantic magazines, Vanity Fair, Wired, and they're all relying on money from us, reader revenue by digital subscriptions.
Well, they're also, it seems to me, when you mention that list, they're all they're aimed at urbanites. And Sunset, I think of as a very, even if you lived in the city, it's a kind of suburban, a notion of gracious suburban living that's there, or the outdoors. And has that just become passé, as much of the West has become intensely urban?
I don't think that it has. I mean, whether it's in L.A. or the Bay Area where I am, you know, we're kind of both urbanites and suburbanites, many of us, right? We enjoy the city. Some of us have some land to garden or to landscape. And everybody likes to think that they entertain. And Sunset was an aspirational magazine. Interestingly now, I mean, kind of think where we're at right now. We've got, as Bill said, you know, grew up in Colorado. We're talking about the American West, even though we think of it in California as a California publication. There's 60 million people, maybe 65 million, in the American West now. But this is not a magazine that captures the moment. The moment is, look, we just had an election. We're talking about the left coast, the big blue wave on the West Coast, how we're the future in terms of the demography of the country. And that's in the atmosphere. But Sunset is a view of an old kind of aspiration about the American West. We all kind of shared, or at least white suburbanites of certain means shared in it. But there's a new idea out there. And I think what's going to be really interesting in media and this idea of the American West is who can figure that out. Patrick Soon-Shiong at the LA Times is trying to figure that out. How much of this is a California publication? So I think there's a new idea out there. Sunset still mired in an old idea, very comfortable.
But it's always been apolitical, Ken. I can't imagine Sunset devoting itself to the impact of the election on California living.
Right. But is there a way that it can reflect the way people live now better? And can it do that in a way that's going to bring in both digital subscriptions and digital advertising.
We're talking with Ken Doctor, a Newsonomics, his site, media analyst. Bill, you want to say something about that?
Well, I agree with Ken. I think if Sunset was anything, it was genteel. And the contemporary American West certainly has its genteel corners. But to reach into a younger audience and think what millennials and people just slightly older than them are interested in about the American West, it's not so much entertaining on their redwood deck. It might be free climbing in El Capitan. So this is a different demographic, and Sunset in their DNA, that's not really suited to what they have been about.
Vicky in Encino says, I'm a fourth-generation Californian. Subscribing to Sunset magazine was a statement. It meant I'd arrived in my career and in my adult life because my parents had always subscribed. I'm still a subscriber. That's Vicky in Encino. That's funny. So whether she reads it or not, having it is sort of – it's a statement. Say, yes, I have entered the dream.
Yeah, and there's a lot to learn from it. There's no question. You know, the Sunset's long had very, very fine writers in its literature. Early days when it was under the editorship of Paul Shoup, the literary and artistic contributors to Sunset were of the first order.
Beautiful photography.
Absolutely.
Table magazine, right?
Yeah, definitely. James in Claremont, good to have you with us.
Hey, thank you. You know, when I moved from Manhattan and the first time I saw Sunset magazine was at the grocery store, and, you know, I made the assumption that it was going to be another dusty old family circle and didn't really look at it for years. Finally, one day, out of sheer boredom, I picked it up and read a few articles, and I was kind of shocked how they focused not only on, you know, folks of money, but also people like me who are trying to discover the city and try to find things that were not super expensive. And like what your guest is saying, I completely agree that the perception of this magazine, people just don't understand it and won't give it a chance until they're actually told.
All right, James, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, it's funny. Yeah, I think for some people there were assumptions about it that were
I'm sure. I mean, certainly in the early days, the assumption was purely an organ of railroad boosterism, and it was guilty of that. But it's had a very long run. 120 years is a long time to put out a magazine like that. And over its course of its life, it's had multiple generations of a different point of view about the American West. And the open question, which I think Ken has helped us to think through, is can it make it deeper into the 21st century? And things don't look so good.
Yeah. And to make it as a digitally dominant magazine,
right,
it's just hard for me to imagine, as you're saying, Ken, that this makes that transition.
Because it's, you know, the reason that the thought leader magazines people are willing to pay for is there's a unique point of view, there's a high quality to them, literary in some cases. If you think about shelter stuff, you think gardening stuff or travel stuff, kind of the staples of that's all over the web, and it's all free.
Ken, I got a break, but as always, appreciate your analysis. Bill Devereaux, thank you so much as well.
Thank you, Larry.
Been a pleasure. Have a great afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10.